From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Democratic National Committee on Friday, out of the blue, filed a lawsuit in federal court alleging that it was a victim of a conspiracy between President Donald Trump's campaign, Russian officials, and the anti-secrecy organization WikiLeaks around the 2016 election. Trump predictably fired off an angry tweet in response. One of his lawyers, Brad Parscale, issued a statement accusing the DNC of using the lawsuit to raise money. Parscale called it a, quote, sham lawsuit about a bogus Russian collusion claim filed by a desperate, dysfunctional, and nearly insolvent Democratic Party, end of quote. The lawsuit comes in the wake of news of special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation in his contact with Trump's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen. Cohen was found to also be representing Fox News host Sean Hannity, who is notorious for his pro-Trump coverage. My guest is Larry Bensky, and a longtime award-winning print and broadcast journalist. He teaches national and international government courses at California State University, East Bay. He also has written for The Nation magazine. He was a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Times Sunday Book Review, and he's been a frequent guest on our program. Welcome back to the show, Larry.
Thank you, Sonali. It's good to be with you and good to be with our Pacifica listeners and Free Speech TV viewers again.
So lots to talk about. Let's go in order of the things that I first mentioned, which is this lawsuit by the DNC. Now, the DNC, I think, feels like it's quite, has a pretty strong case here about being a victim of conspiracy. What do you make of the fact that it's as a lawsuit, and rather than letting the special counsel's investigation go through, the DNC seems to have decided to become proactive?
Well, the Democratic Party, as the normalized, legitimized, and I should say ineffectual opposition in the political system of the United States, has very few avenues open to it. They're getting nowhere with the executive, any kind of negotiations or dealings with the Trump administration and the White House have been very frustrating and fruitless for the Democrats. They're getting nowhere with the legislative branch, which, of course, is controlled by Republicans. They're getting nowhere with the judicial branch either, considering the fact that the Supreme Court and increasingly the courts of appeals and the federal courts are being closed to the Democrats. So what have they got left? File a lawsuit somewhere. Anybody can sue anybody for anything in this country. And that's what the Democrats are doing. I don't think this has any real possibility of even ever getting into a courtroom. And if it does, there's two things about the legal system in the United States. It's not fast and it's not fair. So filing a lawsuit now, they're going to have to find a venue where some judge says it's okay for this to be in a court. They're going to have to find a way to start taking depositions and gathering evidence. And good luck with that, because all kinds of journalists and all kinds of minority Democrats on Capitol Hill, investigators and investigating committees, have tried to look into this whole WikiLeaks and associated manipulations, machinations into the 2016 election. And they haven't gotten very far. They've come up against a stone wall. You add to that the fact that the public in general has long since seemingly tired of this, and there are good reasons and bad reasons for that. The good reasons are that it's hard to connect this to the outcome of the election. A lot of people who look back at the election believe, I think correctly so, that the Democratic Party ran a terrible campaign behind a very flawed candidate, and that's why they lost the presidency. There are also aspects of gerrymandering, which meant that they lost control of Congress, or helped mean that they lost control of Congress. And the idea that this can be turned around in any meaningful way by a lawsuit by the Democratic Party at this point in history is, to me, laughable.
So what do you make of Glenn Greenwald's criticism of the fact that the lawsuit has also included WikiLeaks as part of the conspiracy? Glenn Greenwald has said that this represents a threat to press freedom.
I don't know what he's talking about as far as press freedom goes in WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks is a strange anomaly. It will go down in history as an ugly footnote. It's one extremely egotistical an eccentric person, Julian Assange, who is clearly interested, and you can see this in the numerous documentaries and books about him, was clearly interested only in his own psychosexual graphic exploitation and satisfaction. And the fact that he stumbled across a formula whereby a lot of information, some of it real, some of it imagined, some of it purportedly leading to some sort of conspiracy, the fact that he and WikiLeaks stumbled across all of this and began to release it piecemeal, I don't think that any lawsuit filed against him at this point can be called a threat to free speech and the free circulation of information. What has stopped WikiLeaks from circulating information? Nothing. They've gotten everything that they wanted to out, including stuff that was not vetted, stuff that was tendentious and obviously not true. As I said, it'll go down as a bizarre footnote to electoral history, and I don't think people should spend a whole lot of attention on the free speech issue here. Much more important to the suppression of free speech is Donald Trump's repeated attacks on the media, including the New York Times most recently, which certainly is a flawed means of delivery, but is the best we have in this country. And his White House correspondent, who's the best correspondent that I know of, who's operating in the White House right now, calling her incompetent, biased, et cetera, et cetera. That's ludicrous, of course, to anybody who's followed her works or the course of how the White House is being covered. But on the other hand, with the closed bell jar in which the Fox News followers live, anything like that, which is aimed at the New York Times, which they don't follow and don't look at and don't read and don't understand, anything like that is just red meat for his followers. And that's all it's meant to be. But it is a really intimidating gesture against free speech and deserves a lot of attention.
Now,
no president has dared to or thought it was even appropriate to attack the media like this in the form, especially right, of one reporter.
And I want to get to Trump's favorite reporter, Sean Hannity. But before we do that, staying on the DNC conspiracy lawsuit for another minute, what do you make of Trump's tweet that he basically said, oh, this is a good thing because now we can countersue the DNC for the DNC server that they refused to give to the FBI, the Debbie Wasserman Schultz servers and documents held by the Pakistani mystery man and Clinton emails. What do you make of this?
You find me five people in the United States who aren't associated with political party insider baseball who care or even understand any of this. And I will personally go to each one of their homes at dinner. I mean, this is nonsense. This is complete nonsense. This is the Republicans filing a counter lawsuit. Who's going to file it? His personal attorney? Who's going to file it? Nobody from the government can file it.
His new attorney, Rudy Giuliani, might help him. This is also an interesting angle.
Yeah, it's sort of the ugliest kids on the block forming a protect the wagon strategy, and you have to drag in Giuliani. he's my idea of he's kind of like a legal John Bolton. He's somebody you drag in when you have nobody else left, when everybody refused you and abandoned you. And you want to have somebody in there who expresses himself forcefully and seems to have connections. Giuliani's connections are meaningless at this point in history. He and his connections have all been exposed for what they are, as have John Bolton's. And I don't think that this is a significant political move which will have any positive repercussions for Trump.
Let's move to the Robert Mueller, Special Counsel Robert Mueller's investigation, which has, of course, been going on for many months now. The latest development in that was that Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, is being questioned and his office was raided, which, of course, made Trump extremely angry. Two things that came out of that around the Sean Hannity connection are interesting. Sean Hannity was found to be a client of Michael Cohen. So it's interesting that he shares a lawyer with the same president that he has repeatedly given favorable coverage. And then over the weekend, the Guardian newspaper had an interesting report about Michael Cohen's case revealing that Sean Hannity had some real estate dealings that he took advantage of his Trump connections to boost. So Sean Hannity, the supposed journalist, is now dragged into the Robert Mueller investigation. What do you make of these stories?
Sean Hannity is not a journalist. He's a media figure, and anything he does or anything about him has to be looked at in the context of what rich people do with their money when they want to get richer. And that's what he's been doing, as Trump did. It seems like he's tried to be an acolyte and a follower of Donald Trump's strategies for wealth accretion, including dabbling in legally marginal real estate matters and having shark-like attorneys who can protect him and exploit that kind of thing to make money for their clients and for themselves. I'm not the right person to be talking to about Sean Hannity in one way, because I don't think I've ever watched a minute of him or listened to a minute of him in the media. If I need to know about, or I think I'm even interested in knowing anything about what he's done or said, I pick it up from print media somewhere, and most of the time it's nonsense and can be discarded by people like me. But I am not a Fox television viewer. I never watch Fox television, and I'm certainly not in their carass of followers. The people who are think he is wonderful, just as they think Donald Trump is wonderful, and will hear no evil about him. And if they do hear something about how he's made multi-millions of dollars through real estate dealings, they think, so what? Because Trump has done it, and so have many other mega millionaires and billionaires on this planet.
Well, here's the main point that the Guardian newspaper reveals about the Hannity real estate dealings. The paper found Hannity amassed part of his property collection with support from the U.S. Department for Housing and Urban Development, a fact he did not disclose when praising Ben Carson, Secretary of HUD, on his television show last year. And essentially, the main issue is that here's a guy who is deeply connected in secret and ways that have made him enriched him personally, and in ways that he has not disclosed on the outlet that he is talking about these figures on. Now, I think there's no legal lines that have been crossed here, but clearly journalistic ethical lines have been crossed here. But perhaps by Fox News standards, that doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. Yeah. And you're right to cite perhaps no legal lines have been crossed. These people spend a lot of money. Trump and Hannity, et cetera, et al., spend a lot of time and money hiring lawyers who will tell them where the line is. And if they go over the line, we'll defend them against it and tell them how they can basically not get in trouble because they've gone across the line. I don't think there's anything surprising about this. There's a lot that's disgusting about it. In my point of view, and the point of view that is shared, I'm sure, by an overwhelming percentage of your viewers and listeners, it's disgusting. But is it illegal? Is it unethical? Well, what are these people's ethics and how are they formed? What is most interesting to me in all of this is the excruciating contradiction between having people who believe supposedly in religious-based moral stances taking a position that is clearly and directly against the history of those religious-based moral standards. They are, at the very least, massive hypocrites. And of course, at the worst, their behavior leads to actions which a lot of us believe are criminal.
Now, the real reason, of course, one of the main reasons that Michael Cohen was questioned was the connection with Stormy Daniels, the adult film star who was paid off, we know, by Trump's attorney, Michael Cohen, and what may end up being seen as an illegal campaign contribution by Cohen on behalf of Trump, essentially. And many wonder whether this is going to end up being Trump's undoing. It's just sort of an unlikely twist to the investigation.
It can't, in my mind, possibly be a major cause if he does have an undoing. Wealthy people buying sexual favors from people is as old as the presence of prostitution on this planet, and the idea that it's being done to protect a wealthy politician or a wealthy person. Again, we have abundant examples in American as well as world history.
But isn't the question that this would have been an unregistered campaign contribution?
A question for whom, Sonali? I mean, who's going to make that judgment? Certainly nobody in the federal campaign surveillance operation, either the so-called independent commission, which basically does nothing, or congressional investigations, which are now set up by the ruling party to do nothing. It's not going to be that kind of a question. Now, could it be collateral damage, we might say, if there were other impeachment-type investigations going on against Trump? Sure, it could be. But it takes a long stretch of the imagination, which is beyond my imagination, and I believe I have an informed imagination on this subject, to see anything like a payoff to a previous sex relationship by Donald Trump or by Michael Cohen or by any of those people. It's hard for me to see it being an element in the weakening of Donald Trump to the point where he was presidency would be in danger because of this.
So now, as Trump is in the thick of all of this, what's really interesting is that well into his second year as president, he's finally he's hosting the French president, an important state visit. What is there for us to note about this issue, given that the French president Emmanuel Macron is sort of seen like Canada's Justin Trudeau, sort of a liberal counterpoint, more Obama-like than Trump-like?
Bienvenue, Monsieur Macron. J'aimerais bien parler avec vous pendant votre séjour parmi nous. Welcome, Monsieur Macron. I would love to talk to you while you stay here this week. You can see this in a lot of different ways. Macron is not seen in France as anything like a neoliberal like Monsieur Trudeau in Canada. Macron is seen like a cynical, personalized opportunist who has abandoned all of his supposed center-left political principles in order to build up his presidency, and it's not working. He's unable to get the kinds of changes that he says he wants through the French political system, which is a very difficult political system to get any changes through. He's unable to provide any kind of benefits to the people who voted for him and those who didn't in France. He's in a very dangerous position politically for his own and for his movement's political future in France. Now, given that background, coming over to the United States for a few headlines and a few hugs, is that a good strategy? It's a desperate strategy. It doesn't really make any sense. Donald Trump is, if anything, more unpopular in France than he is here. Trump thinks of France, if he thinks of it at all, obviously, as a kind of museum of glitter, bling, wine, and cheese. And when he goes over there, all he has is, extremely rarefied upper crust exposure to anything that's going on or has gone on in France. Dinner on the Eiffel Tower, visits to fancy jewelers and fancy couturiers. It's a ridiculous kind of bling magazine, the kind of thing the New York Times Sunday Style magazine would profile with approval, but it has absolutely no connection to the French and the French people, who understand him as a dangerous, eccentric, unqualified egotist, understand Trump as such, by and large, and have no interest in seeing their country via Macron get any closer to Trump. So who knows what's going to go on in the background? I mean, those who are writing about this with some insight say that what they're really going to be doing is talking about keeping Trump from going crazy and the people around him from going crazy about Iran, and pointing out to him that if it's a game of cards or a game of twiddlesticks, if you pull one out of the pile, you really don't know how the whole thing is going to collapse. And Trump doesn't think that way, nor do people like John Bolton and some of the other eccentrics who surround him on foreign policy. That Macron is going to try to point out that you really shouldn't say you're going to punish Iran more, because Iran can punish us more, us being Europe. And you may feel in the United States you're isolated from those consequences. but we're not. And so don't expose us to having to make ugly type decisions and disassociate ourselves from you by some thoughtless action that you've taken impulsively. I think behind the scenes, they may well be able to have that kind of conversation. On the other hand, Trump is not going to be respectful of Macron. Trump is going to be well-versed in who Macron is, which is a political outlier who, by a strange series of electoral circumstances, like Trump himself, got elected, doesn't represent an organized political presence in France, and may well disappear in the short run from, as his movement will, from the political scene. So Trump does not have to take Macron as some sort of Charles de Gaulle, who's a historical figure that you'll have to deal with as a trendsetter forever. And I think they both understand each other's strengths and weaknesses in that sense. It's more headline and image grabber, the visit of Macron this week, than it will have anything of substance. But I should say, if it does have something of substance, we won't know anything about it. Because one of the consequences of the cutback in journalism in this country, where there are fewer and fewer reporters from fewer and fewer mainstream institutions covering fewer and fewer things, is that we don't have that many people qualified anymore to even speak French, much less understand the geopolitics involved. So I would look to the international press. The Guardian, as you said, is a good place to look for coverage about what's really going to be going on during Macron's visit.
Well, Larry, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and I'm sure we'll have you back on our program in the future.
It's always a privilege and honor, and hello once again to our Pacifica and Free Speech TV viewers and listeners. Support these institutions we need.
Thank you. Larry Bensky is a longtime award-winning print and broadcast journalist. He teaches courses in national and international government at Cal State University, East Bay. He's written for The Nation magazine, was a regular contributor to the Los Angeles Times Sunday Book Review, and more. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.